In the last session, we had the opportunity to talk briefly about new concepts in the way science and Western physics is beginning to view our universe. Specifically, the idea that we live in a world of many, many, many dimensions, at least 10 dimensions that are required through the new theories, the superstring theories of the universe. Well, along with those new views of dimensionality have come new understandings of time. Precisely what time means to us in our lives. Now, time is such a fascinating topic to be able to share with audiences. It's a universal phenomenon almost that I'm experiencing as I've had the opportunity to travel throughout the world in the last 18 months or so. And what I've found is that almost universally, people all over the world feel as if time is speeding up. Things are happening faster in their lives. And maybe you notice this in your lives as well. I thought at first maybe it was just an American phenomenon or a Western phenomenon, but I found it in the jungles of South America. I found it in the arid deserts of the highlands of Asia. So my sense is, at this point, it appears to be almost a universal phenomenon, and I believe that it is tied to changes that are happening, physical changes happening within our world and within our Earth. And if we are perceiving time differently, and if time works a little differently than we have thought perhaps in the past through the view of the new physics, it lends itself and presents opportunities in terms of the events of our lives and how they play out in the world around us. And I'd like to share a story just to illustrate this point, maybe to help understand a little bit about how our expectation or lack thereof of what happens in our lives affects the group experience. 1992, I had a group of Westerners in Egypt, and we were on a 14-day journey, pilgrimage, throughout Egypt that had carried us all through the pyramids and through the temples and down the Nile, all the way over onto the Sinai Peninsula. And we had just spent 3 days in Mount Sinai in Egypt in the St. Catherine's Monastery area. We were on our way back into Cairo, into Giza, the Giza Plateau, and the finale of this particular journey was that we would be given private access inside the Great Pyramid at midnight that night. We would go into the structure and the guards would close the doors behind us, and we'd have the opportunity to experience this in the intimacy of our own group. And I'm sharing this in detail because this is very important, the expectation, the feeling of what the group was experiencing during that period of time. We left our village in St. Catherine about 8 o'clock in the morning. And we began driving them along windy roads in the Sinai Mountains to the highways along the Red Sea. And following the Red Sea, we come up underneath the Suez Canal. We go through the battlefields of the Six-Day War between the Egyptians and the Israelis. In the area, it's both very desolate and very beautiful all at the same time. We were going through checkpoints all the way through. About every 20 minutes, our bus would have to stop for a security checkpoint. Someone would board the bus. They'd look over all of our papers, all of our identification, and ask us some questions, and they would leave. And there's a reason I'm sharing that detail as well, because every 20 minutes or so, the bus had to stop and had to go through one of these checkpoints, and there were a specific number of checkpoints along the way. Well, as we made our journey along the Sinai and the Suez and came up onto the mainland, the continent of Africa, we were engaged in conversation. Everyone was very excited about the opportunity to go inside of the Great Pyramid. We've been anticipating this for the entire journey. And there were people that began asking themselves, I wonder what it feels like to be inside. And rather than thinking about how long it was taking them to get to Cairo, they began feeling what they imagined it would feel like to be inside of the Great Pyramid in Egypt. And all of a sudden, our bus came to a stop, and we looked out the windows, and we saw that our driver had gotten out of his bus, and we had a military escort both in front of us and behind us, a covered jeep that had a number of soldiers armed before us and then following us behind just for security. And they were getting out of their vehicle. Our translator had just stepped down off of the bus, and they were all milling around in front of the bus, scratching their heads, looking at their watches with very perplexed looks on their faces. And as the group leader, I felt it was my responsibility to find out what was going on so I could let our group know that everything was okay. So I got off the bus and I walked over to my very good friend and my translator and guide. And I asked him, what in the world is going on? And he looked at me and he said, my friend Greg, in his Egyptian accent, we can't be here yet. And I said, what do you mean we cannot be here yet? He says, it's too soon. We can't be here yet. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, if we leave St. Catherine's Monastery at 8 o'clock in the morning, it's at least an 8-hour drive. If we follow the speed limit all the way into Cairo, and he said, we've been stopping at checkpoints every 20 minutes. He said, we can't be here. It's impossible. And I said, but Mohammed, we're here. And what he said to me, he says, no, he says, this is a miracle. It's a miracle. And all of the guards were looking at their watches to find out what their watches were saying. And the interesting thing was that all of the watches had sped ahead to the time that it would have been if we had arrived in Cairo following the 8-hour drive. However, it had only taken us 4 hours, according to the clocks on the buildings around us and to the drivers in the other vehicles. It had only taken about half the amount of time. People on the bus began asking what was happening, and I've seen this phenomenon with individuals before. I've never seen it with a large group. And it was interesting to me to see it with a large group because it appeared to be so much easier. And here's what I believe happened that day with that group. What Western science is telling us today is that through the power of human emotion, we have direct access to the four fundamental forces of nature. And we discussed this in our last section. Inherent in those forces is our perception of time and space and distance. What was happening with the people in our group on this journey is that rather than feeling the feeling of how long the trip was taking to get to where we were going, rather than saying, are we there yet? Or how much longer is it going to take? They were engaged in genuine, it was genuine, heartfelt conversations of emotion, of the exuberance and the anticipation and the joy of already being in the chambers of the pyramid. They were speaking among themselves about what they were feeling when they were having discussions, what they were feeling in the upper chamber, the king's chamber, or the middle, or the queen's chamber. And what I believe happened in that experience, if it were only one person that had experienced this shift in time, I would suspect that that person was having an altered experience of one form or another. The fact that the entire bus of about 50 or 55 people, plus the driver, plus the military personnel in the security vehicles in front of us and behind us, suggests that we were all enveloped in a field of sorts, the heart field, if you will, and that we all participated in the experience of literally compressing time in a way that can only be done through the effortless experience of human feeling rather than the effort of human thought and what is required for the thought processes. This was not a logical process. It was a feeling-based process. Many of you listening to this had the opportunity to see a movie in recent years. It was the movie Ghost with Patrick Swayze. And there's a place in the movie where Patrick Swayze was coming to terms with the fact that he had died. It took him a while to understand that he was no longer in a physical body. And not being in a physical body, his interaction with the physical world did not work the same. So one of the examples, and it was such a powerful example to see, was on the ramp of the subway station, and there was a can lying on the ground, and he was attempting to do something that he had done many times while he was alive in a physical body. He wanted to kick the can. And every time he tried to kick the can, because he was no longer a physical being, he was not interacting with the can in the same way, and nothing happened. His foot would pass right through it. And the more times he would miss, the more frustrated he would get. And it was in this experience that another person came along who was also no longer in body and recognized the experience that Patrick Swayze was having and taught him that it's not about brute force and showed him how to feel the can being kicked. And once that experience was understood, he was able to kick the can and he began doing it again and again and again. It was an effortless feeling rather than the effort and the exertion of the logic and the thought processes that he'd been trying to do earlier. So it's a wonderful example in modern cinema of the way that this works. Well, I share this story because our understanding of time and what time means and how it's associated with human emotion is changing so quickly today through the understandings and the findings of quantum physics and Western science on the one hand, and on the other hand, we're now recovering the lost wisdom in ancient texts and traditions that begin to tell us precisely how we may apply our new scientific understandings of these processes, our new understandings of time. One of the phenomena that I've noticed is I've attended the conferences and the keynote lectures and the programs where scientists and researchers are speaking about precisely the things that we're sharing right now, is this: a growing number of scientists are saying, yes, this field appears to be there, and we do appear to be connected, and they're asking the next question: what do we do with it? What does it mean? How do we use it in our lives? And this is, I believe, where the beauty of these ancient understandings and ancient traditions come from, because science has already proved it. The ancients weren't trying to prove it. They spent hundreds and thousands of years learning how to apply what these relationships mean in our lives. The idea that time doesn't work the way that we would expect time to work, perhaps, isn't such a brand new idea. In what may be perhaps the most telling statement that Albert Einstein left to us regarding his views of time and space and the way we work in our world, I'd like to share with you a quote of Einstein's perspective on the nature of time and how it works in our lives. Einstein said that time is not at all what it seems. It does not flow in only one direction, and he said that the future exists simultaneously with the past. When I was in school and we were studying time through physics and the sciences of my day, I was taught that time moves in two directions, that we have the past is the history that's behind us, and we have a future that is yet to be lived. And while these two elements of time certainly exist, what we know now is that there is a third element of time that has not been accounted for in recent times in conventional wisdom, conventional science. And that is within the present moment, within the very moment that you and I are sharing this information right now, time exists as many, many, many layers, layers of possibilities. Within this very instant, there are many, many other instants that are playing out, each slightly different in nature, each slightly different in the way the events of those instants unfold in our lives. This third component of time now is called vertical time. Vertical time. So not only do we have a past and a future, but in the present, there are many presents that are unfolding in each instant of our lives, is what we call vertical time. So the question is, now, if time does, in fact, travel in two directions, is it possible that those two directions have multiple lanes? In other words, when we see the events of our lives playing out, or the ancients describe those events in the language of their time, is it possible that events that look like they have begun from one perspective could have a very, very different outcome by changing lanes of time along the way? So interesting, when we look into the traditions of those who have come before us to see the way that time is described in such a linear fashion, typically through the use of words like the ribbons of time or the roads of time, the waves or the lanes or the paths of time. So when we're thinking of time from this perspective, in your mind's eye, if you can think of the moment that you're experiencing right now and consider the possibility that there are many, many, many other moments that are unfolding in this instant, and you are participating in each of those moments, and each of those moments is a slightly different outcome and a slightly different possibility. It holds a slightly different potential from where we are in this very moment. So the question, if this time that exists as rivers and waves and roads, in fact, is traveling in these two directions, can an event in our lives begin in one lane and change lanes to result in a different outcome later on in time? In other words, if the events that begin along one lane of time jump lanes during their journey and they arrive at a given point in time, a different lane with a different outcome, what some have called the quantum leap, what does that mean in terms of ancient descriptions of prophecy? When the ancients were looking from their perspective into our future, what were they really seeing and what were they really describing? If time, in fact, works the way that I'm suggesting in this discussion, it may very well be that when an ancient prophet was standing in his moment in history, hundreds or thousands of years ago, and in his mind's eye, he or she were looking into the future, rather than seeing the events as linear progressions of one thing that must happen after another, that must happen after another, is it possible that what the prophets were actually describing in the only language that they knew, in the words of their time, that they were seeing the vertical time, that they were seeing the multiple events, the possibilities that could happen, and if so, how else could they have described them other than in what to us sounds like a linear fashion? So when a prophet was seeing and describing our future as a time of destruction and disaster and death and decay, and in the same instant of time, the prophet also sees a time of birth and regrowth and joy and peace and healing. And scholars look at these descriptions today and they say, well, which is it? Which can it be? We can't have both, or can we? Is it possible that when the prophets were looking from their perspective into their future, and in some cases into the future that still remains before us, what they were actually describing to us were the myriad possibilities that the physics of time hold in store for us? And if so, were they also then describing to us the technology of how we may choose which of the futures they envisioned to become the reality of our lives? If this is so, if this is true, the implications are vast. This concept of time implies the possibility that regardless of what a situation looks like in the present moment, we are not locked into one particular outcome. Whether we're talking about the healing of our bodies, or the bodies of our friends or loved ones, or the peace between nations, the peace of our world, even if someone that we know, or perhaps is happening to us personally, even if our health appears to be deteriorating and all the indications from the doctors, the medical community, all the chemical tests say to us that we are experiencing a deterioration in our bodies, from this perspective, that is only one possibility, and if carried to its logical conclusion, can have disastrous results on the one hand. And on the other hand, because it is only one of many, many possibilities, it suggests that through something that we may do, shifting the focus of where we place our awareness in vertical time, in the many possibilities of time, we can make the quantum leap and jump from the road or the path or the river of time where it appears that our bodies may be deteriorating into a new path where we are vital, rejuvenated, healthy, fully enabled, fully capacitated and intact. And in fact, it appears that is precisely what many of the ancient traditions understood in the language of their time, and in the only words they knew, they attempted to convey this wisdom to us in their future in a language that we're only beginning to understand. Now, we're going to describe these possibilities and develop this concept throughout the rest of the program. And I'll say right now that the key to everything that we're about to do, if time in fact exists the way we're suggesting, the key is that even though all the possibilities already exist, all the possibilities of peace and healing and joy, as well as death and destruction and frustration and anger and hate and rage, even though they all coexist simultaneously, the key is that we must claim the experience that we choose for ourselves and our families and our communities and our world, and the science of claiming how we focus and experience our lives each day is the science of navigating through the mind of God. In 1957, Princeton University professor Dr. Hugh Everett III proposed precisely the kinds of understandings that I'm sharing with you right now. 1957, Hugh Everett III proposed that we do in fact live in a world of many, many possibilities, and he coined a term. He called these possibilities parallel universes. Parallel universes. And he used this concept to explain the very puzzling realities that were being detected in the quantum world even during that time. In a paper released in 1957 entitled Relative State Formation of Quantum Mechanics, very technical sounding paper, Hugh Everett III is actually sharing the concepts that were left to us in theory from some of our most ancient and indigenous traditions of our past, as well as the remaining traditions that we have the opportunity to explore today. And in these traditions, they say precisely what Hugh Everett III is saying, that in fact, the mathematics support the possibility of many, many, many possibilities, or many, many, many eventualities in every moment of our lives. And that it is through a process that we may consciously evoke within our bodies, that we place the focus of our awareness and determine which of those realities plays out in our world, in our personal world, in our collective world, in the world around us. Hugh Everett III, in describing these many possibilities, began to understand that there are times in the continuum of space and time where the rivers or the paths or the roads become very, very close to one another. And it is in this closeness that we have an opportunity to leap from one possibility to another in a fashion that may be easier than it is at other times. He called these moments where the possibilities almost touch one another in the fabric of time, he called them choice points. Choice points. And what he said is that choice points exist on many, many levels of reality. We go through little choice points in every moment of our lives that lead to collective choice points in communities and states and countries and nations that lead to global choice points. And the fact of his statements, and the reason that I'm sharing these with you now, is that both ancient and indigenous traditions, and now through the language of 20th century science, as formulated by Hugh Everett III and now many other scientists since his time, what they are suggesting and what the ancients are reminding us of is that we are never locked into the reality that we believe we have created in our world. No matter how the odds appear to be stacked against us, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of health or in terms of the peace of our world, even if the nations of the world are at a fevered pitch of frustration, dialogue has broken down, arms have escalated, and it appears that the nations of the world are moving into war, it doesn't mean necessarily that war must ensue. Because between the moment that the war begins and the moment where we observe all of the events leading to that war, there are many, many choice points. The key is we must recognize that choice points exist. And once we recognize them, we must understand how to implement them, how to apply them in our lives. For example, we have just lived through the end of the 20th century. And as the new millennium was dawning upon us, there were many, many very frightening predictions and prophecies about very frightening things that would unfold with the dawning of the 21st century. According to Dr. Hugh Everett III, as we were barreling down the path of time that was leading us into the 21st century, the parameters were in place, and certainly many of those predictions could have come true. We could have had a global collapse of power grids. We could have had a global outbreak of conflict that led to war. The fact is that none of those happened. And according to the model that Dr. Huber III left for us, this may be the reason why. As we were moving toward that point where the 20th and the 21st century became our reality, if we had continued upon the same path, upon the same path that had led to all those prophecies and predictions and where all the pieces were in place for the most frightening scenarios, if we continued on that, there's a possibility that all those things could have happened. However, according to this model of choice points, as we entered into the collective choice point, enough people in our world, enough people on planet Earth said, no, we're choosing a future of peace. We're choosing a future of prosperity, of health, of good things. We've had enough of the frightening prophecies and predictions in our past. And it is in that kind of thinking that we had the opportunity to leap from one possibility into another and come out on the other side in a reality where none of them ever came to pass. The reason this is important, this becomes important when we begin speaking about the power of prayer and the lost modality of prayer based in human emotion and the ability that prayer appears to have to bring about miraculous changes inside of our bodies as well as in our world. From the perspective of this model of time, there are many, many, many possibilities that are playing out in any one moment in time as individuals and then as families and then as communities and then as nations and then as a world. We find ourselves experiencing the reality where we place our focus. Very, very simply, where we place our focus, the focus of our hearts, the focus of our consciousness determines which of those ribbons of time, which of those possibilities actually play out as the reality of our lives. Well, these concepts, very nebulous, very esoteric concepts in some respects, when we talk about time and space, they're giving new meaning to the word prophecy. And I'll just share with you right now from the perspective of a scientist. As a scientist, 20, 25 years ago, if I walked into a room and began speaking to a room full of scientists about prophecy, I would see a lot of eyes glaze over, and the ones that didn't were probably because they were on their way out the door in the back of the room. For the simple reason that science, up until recently, has not taken prophecy very seriously. However, through the understandings, such as those suggested by Hugh Everett III, prophecy is taking on a new meaning. Now, the word prophecy is no longer used, but the idea that an individual in a moment in space and time may project their awareness, their consciousness, through the fabric of space-time into a distant or a future event is being taken very seriously by Western science. It's given a new name today. Today it's called remote viewing. Remote viewing. I'll define remote viewing, the many ways we could define it, as the ability to simply project our consciousness as well as our senses through the medium of space and time. The idea of remote viewing and the protocols, the principles regarded in carrying out what we now call remote viewing were developed at the prestigious Stanford Research Institute, SRI, throughout the 1970s. The principle was carried to such a degree and taken so seriously, it was actually used during the Gulf War. We began using remote viewers, in a sense, modern prophets, to pinpoint the location of enemy missiles, of Scud missiles during the Gulf War, narrowing down the parameters of where those missiles might be located before we ever sent humans onto the ground, and thus narrowed the risk of human life by determining within a range of geographic area where those missiles may in fact be hidden. So the concept of projecting consciousness through space and time and looking at events either in this reality or in a time ahead of us or behind us is a concept that's taken very seriously by science today. So what if ancient prophets were taking the same science just as seriously in the only way they knew how in their time? Once again, what if they were describing what we would call quantum possibilities as Nostradamus or Edgar Cayce or many of the ancient Egyptian prophets, as they sat in their temples hundreds or thousands of years ago, or in the case of Edgar Cayce, as he sat on the couch in his office and went into his altered state, his dreamlike state, and they had the ability to navigate the rivers and the roads and the paths, the ribbons of time, to see what events were lying ahead if we were to follow precisely that river or road of time. And then they came back to us and shared with us what they were seeing. The way they would describe it would be precisely the way that we see it in our text today. They would describe one after another after another. It would appear to us as if they were describing a linear series of events. Nostradamus, for example, described periods of time where he saw death and decay and destruction in the great cities of the earth. And then, in the same period of time, he said that there was healing, that there was peace, and there was joy. And this is where the scholars are so frustrated in interpreting ancient prophecy, because to them it appears that one must happen before the other. However, with the understanding of quantum possibilities, this simply is not the case. Consider yourself an ancient prophet, and in your mind's eye, you're seeing all the possibilities as a gradation from the best of the best to the worst of the worst. And as you describe them to the people of your future, imagine how you would list one after another after another. It doesn't necessarily mean that the events unfold in a linear fashion. It simply is that you are describing a linear series of events, or the events in a linear fashion. So if this is the case, what were the prophets saying to us? Were they all saying that we must go through a period of tribulation before we reach redemption in our personal lives as well as our global lives? As the Native Americans suggest, is it necessary for us to go through a personal purification before we reach the healing, or for our world to go through a global purification before it reaches the healing? Or were those ancient prophecies describing very real scenarios that await us in the quantum possibilities in the mind of God? And if so, do you really believe they would have shown us such possibilities without giving us very precise clues, very precise instructions in terms of how we may choose which of those possibilities we experience in our lives? In the next section, what I'd like to do is develop this concept through the eyes of one very specific prophet. I'd like to examine the information and the instructions that were left to us by one who is considered the very first Old Testament prophet, the great Isaiah. And we'll do this through some of the most amazing documents left to us, recovered in the 20th century among the Dead Sea Scrolls, the great Isaiah Scroll. The discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls has been described as the single most important archaeological find of the 20th century. And for most of my adult life, I have, in one way or another, studied these scrolls, what they mean to us in our lives today, what they meant during the time of their creation, where the information has come from, and how the people 2,000, 2,200, 2,500 years ago, how they knew the information that they recorded in these scrolls. Where did they get their information from? Was it part of an older lineage of wisdom that had been passed down from generation to generation to generation? And if so, where did it come from to begin with? Well, one of the fascinating items of interest to me regarding the scrolls, one of the questions I had was, why has it taken so long for this information to be disseminated among the general public? The first scrolls were found in 1946. They were reported to the public in 1947. As we mentioned earlier, between 1947 and 1959, in 11 caves, over 22,000 fragments, papyrus, animal hide, and copper, were found and eventually pieced together into what became 900 or so scrolls. And in those 900 or so scrolls, every letter had to be translated, and all the translations had to be compiled and then released as publications. I find it so fascinating that the entire task, this monumental task that spanned decades, was left to a team of only 7 male scholars. And up until 1991, those 7 scholars were primarily the only people that had firsthand access to the original information in these scrolls. Well, of all of the scrolls that were found, over those 22,000 plus fragments that eventually became those 900 scrolls, and all the controversy that surrounded all of this information, ironically, it was in the first cave where the first 7 scrolls were found that those first 7 scrolls also were the most complete documents of the entire find of all the Dead Sea Scrolls. I think it's perhaps no accident that those scrolls were together and that they were found so early on. Today, just outside of Jerusalem, they are housed in a structure, a beautiful structure that has won a tremendous number of architectural awards. And when we look at the exterior of the structure, we're immediately taken by the shape of one portion of the roof. It appears as a saucer shape that is actually fabricated to look like the lid of one of the clay vases on a very large scale where the scrolls were found in the caves originally. There's a large white dome that covers a chamber inside of the Shrine of the Book Museum. And when we go inside of that chamber, what we find are housed the first 7, those first 7 scrolls that have always been considered as a unit unto themselves. They've always been displayed together. And along the periphery of the circular chamber, 6 of the scrolls are available for display in cases. They are unrolled, and we can file by and read letter by letter the flecks of ink on the ancient parchment precisely the way the hands of the scribes placed them there over 2,000 years ago. Well, it's in the center of this chamber that, for me, is perhaps one of the most fascinating enigmas of the entire Dead Sea Scrolls saga. In the center of this chamber is a vertical steel cylinder, and on this cylinder is unrolled the single scroll, the only one of all the 22,500 fragments, all the 900 scrolls that eventually pieced together, only one was found completely intact. And that one scroll is unrolled on this vertical steel cylinder and is believed by scholars to be so precious, they will not even use the word valuable. This scroll cannot be viewed in terms of dollars and cents. The information is so precious that enormous measures, extraordinary measures, have been taken to preserve this scroll for future generations. The entire display in the center of the chamber, the entire scroll wrapped around this vertical cylinder, is designed to retract into the floor of the museum itself, underneath the floor, into a steel and concrete reinforced vault. And over this vault, steel doors are designed to close to protect and preserve this single document above all other documents in the event even of a natural disaster or a nuclear attack in the city of Jerusalem. Because the scholars say that this one scroll above all other scrolls must be preserved for future generations. This is the great Isaiah scroll. And we have to ask ourselves, what could possibly be on this scroll that warrants such extraordinary degrees of protection? What does this scroll say to us? Well, of the many, many concepts that Isaiah, the great prophet Isaiah, developed in the 66 books of his scroll, for me, I believe the key concept is precisely the concept of his understanding of space, of time, of the relationship between space and time and human events, both of his time and of his future. We feel that we get to know Isaiah as he shares with us his vision of a time ahead of his time and perhaps a time into our future as well. Because not only does he share his perspective of the possibilities that he sees unfolding, Isaiah takes us one step further, and he almost pleads, he almost begs the people of his future. He says, please, live your lives in a way that I'm about to describe to you so that you will never have to experience the horrible things that I've seen as possibilities for your future. What is it that Isaiah saw? What is it that he's inviting us to change in our lives so that we don't have to live the kinds of things that he saw in his future? From the perspective of vertical time, if we consider Isaiah as an ancient, remote viewer, from his place in our history over 2,000 years ago, as Isaiah peered through the consciousness of his mind's eye and his heart into the rivers and roads of time of his future, he began to describe the visions, the quantum possibilities, what I believe are the quantum possibilities, in the only way that he knew how. And I'm going to share some of these with you. Listen to the way these possibilities sound and see how you feel in your body as you hear the possibilities unfold. And then Isaiah begins to share something very different and see how different you feel when you hear of the other possibilities. He begins his description of a time in his future. He says he sees a time when the earth shakes, the foundations of the earth will shake, he says. And he awakens in a time where the great cities of the earth are blackened, in a time that he says few people are left, there are few that are remaining alive. And he describes a cataclysm that he sees unfolding upon the surface of the earth, obviously a very frightening prophecy. However, the same instant in time, Isaiah also begins to describe a vision of hope and possibility and peace and joy, because he says a new earth appears. And he goes on to say that all the things of the past shall not be remembered or come to mind. He's saying all the suffering, all the horrible things we've seen in the past, we'll no longer remember. We won't think of them any longer. And he says, no longer shall the sound of weeping be heard or the sound of crying. He goes on describing how water will spring forth from what were the deserts of the earth. The diseased are healed. He says, the deaf shall hear and the blind shall see. I've got to share with you from the perspective of modern scholars that I've spoken with and scientists, these kinds of descriptions just make them crazy, absolutely crazy, because they say, what is this guy talking about? Which is it? Is he looking at a time of death and destruction, or is he looking at a time of peace and healing? And without the understanding of vertical time, the only answer that makes sense to them is, ah, he must be describing the hard times that we must experience before we get to the good times. They're looking at this from a linear perspective. Well, while that certainly may be a possibility, based on what we now know of time from modern science, and based on what Isaiah is about to share with us through the words of his time, my sense is that these are not linear events that must unfold. And I should probably share with you that I am an optimist. And I believe in the wisdom and the power of our species. I believe that collectively, we each carry a piece of the answer that helps us to transcend the great challenges of our time and history, and that collectively, as we pool all of our little answers together, that collectively we become the great answer to this time in history. So it's from that perspective, I think it's only fairer for me to mention that as I go into what it is that Isaiah is sharing with us. So he has seen the worst of the worst and the best of the best. And what I believe is happening is that he is relating to us as he is visually moving through the rivers and the roads of vertical time, the range of possibilities that he is seeing as potential futures only. Because then he goes on to describe a very, very powerful key. It's a key that's known sometimes as the key of redemption. Isaiah begins to describe a key that he calls the mysterious mountain. And I'll just share some of this key with you, and then we'll discuss what it means. Isaiah says, within a mountain. So he's described all of his visions of the future, all the death and destruction, the peace and the joy. And now he's saying, within this mountain, he says, you will find a refuge for the poor, a refuge to the needy in distress. Within this mountain, you'll find shelter from the rain, shade from the heat. He says, from the mountain, this mysterious mountain, he says, the veil that veils all peoples, the web that is woven over all nations will be destroyed. That is a direct quote out of Isaiah's text. The web that is woven over all nations will be destroyed. What is Isaiah's key? What is this mountain all about? Well, for hundreds of years, scholars taking this as a literal scripture have searched for a physical mountain throughout the Middle East. They're saying, wow, a mountain where people are healed and where the deaf can hear and the eyes can see. This is the kind of mountain we'd like to find. Where is this mountain? Well, is it possible that Isaiah's mountain was not a physical mountain at all? And the answer to that question lies in the language of Isaiah's description itself, in the ancient Hebrew language. When I'm speaking of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the languages that the scrolls were recorded in have been key in helping us understand and translate and decipher what they are actually conveying to us. The primary languages that these scrolls were written in are ancient biblical Hebrew, Aramaic, and a smattering of Greek. And it is the ancient biblical Hebrew word for the mountain that Isaiah is describing that offers the clue of what he may be inviting us to change in our lives. So let's look at the word mountain. In biblical Hebrew, the word mountain itself, during the time that's believed that the scrolls were written, the word mountain was a symbolic reference. It's not a reference to a physical mountain at all. It's a symbolic reference used to represent a place that is called the heavenly Jerusalem. The heavenly Jerusalem. So the mountain is a metaphor for heavenly Jerusalem. It might help a little bit, but now we have to ask, what is a heavenly Jerusalem? We know we don't have a physical mountain, but are we really much better off with something called a heavenly Jerusalem? What does that mean? Well, if we research further in the ancient texts and the way the translations have come about, we find something fascinating. Something fascinating unfolds before our eyes in these translations. Because in biblical Hebrew, the word for Jerusalem is Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, and it translates literally to the vision of peace. The vision of peace. Yerushalayim translates into the vision of peace. So if we go back into the original text and we replace what Isaiah is saying to us with the translation that we've just developed over the last few moments, what we find is Isaiah is saying, within the vision of peace, we find a refuge to the poor. Within a vision of peace, we find a refuge to the needy in distress. It's from a vision of peace that we find shelter from the rain, shade from the heat, and it is from the vision of peace that the veil that veils all peoples, the web that is woven over all nations, will be destroyed. And Isaiah goes on then to describe that from this vision of peace, if we can embody this in our lives, that we do not need to experience the most frightening visions of our future that he has seen from his place and time. The vision of peace. Well, this understanding and understandings like this offer fresh insight into Isaiah's message specifically, and to other kinds of message in general. If we can take one specific prophecy, such as what Isaiah is sharing with us, and we can unravel the code that has been left for us in this prophecy, then that one becomes essentially a template. Once we understand one, we can take those understanding and overlay them onto other ancient prophecies and see if maybe there are not similar hidden codes or hidden references, verbal codes or references to something that we can do in our lives in those places. So having peered from his time in history into his future, into perhaps our time or maybe our future, what Isaiah is sharing with us is he's witnessed two very, very different possibilities in time. He has witnessed a time of peace and healing. He's witnessed a time of war and destruction. And at the same time, he has admonished those who he was certain would read his words in the future to avoid the suffering of the darkest of his visions by simply reconsidering the choices that they make in their lives, by finding the peace and the vision of peace that he's describing and implementing it into their lives as a literal code of conduct, a way of living. What we now know is that that vision of peace is more than simply a paragraph or a phrase or a series of words that describe a nice opportunity in our future. It literally may be considered an internal technology, a way of focusing consciousness inside of our bodies and in a specific place in our bodies, within our hearts, that allows us to speak the language of creation, to speak into the mind of God, into the quantum hologram, and in doing so, to focus our awareness as individuals and as families and communities and as nations into the kinds of experiences and the kinds of futures of healing and peace that we claim that we would like to experience in our lives. In the language of their time, the Essenes said to us, the world around us is nothing more, nothing less than the mirror of what we've become in our hearts. There's a literal translation for that. If we have become anger, rage, hate, jealousy in here, and we carry that all day long, you can full well expect to see it in your office, in your family, with your friends, in your schools, in your communities, and between nations. If we have become peace, understanding, forgiveness, compassion, doesn't mean you let the world roll over you. It means that we've got a new way of dealing with what the world shares with us. They were giving us the technology. Everything we've done in here up until this moment is in that scroll in the language of a different time. Isaiah says to us, you have direct access to the forces of your world. You are the product of what you believe to be in your world. And this is how you may apply what I'm saying to you in your world in the future so that you never have to experience the horrible things that I've seen in my visions. He said that to us. He almost pleads with us, as do other prophets. They almost plead. They say, please, change the way you live your life so that you never have to experience what I've seen as the possibility. Now we know the quantum possibilities of life. The quantum hologram not only links all of creation in ways that we're only beginning to understand. That's only one piece of it. The second piece says that the quantum hologram holds the blueprint of every possibility that you could ever imagine that it will ever unfold in our lives at any time, past, present, or future. Doesn't mean that they're active. It means that the blueprint, the possibility is there. The quantum hologram not only links the events of creation, it holds the blueprint of all possibilities. What does that mean? What does that mean? How many of you have heard it said we create our reality? You hear that a lot, and sometimes it's used in really cruel ways. When people have a very difficult time in life and their friends and family can't deal with it and they're in denial, what they'll say is, oh, well, you created that. You knew you were going to do that. And then they lead people to wallow in their agony. Well, I understand what people say. We create our reality. From the perspective of what quantum physics is saying to us, it may be more accurate to say that all possibilities that you could ever imagine are already created. They're already there as blueprints. It may be more accurate to say that we choose which reality we awaken rather than saying we choose which reality we create. Maybe you've heard this in your sacred religious or spiritual traditions where the masters, Jesus said to us, he said, you're already healed. He said that to the lepers. So they're sitting there watching their bodies change before their eyes. What did he mean by that? If the possibility, the blueprint is already there, he may be saying, you're already healed in the possibility. Now you must claim it in your life. The way you claim it is through the language that speaks to that possibility. Not necessarily the spoken language, it's the language of human emotion. By the way, now I can say this, the interesting thing, many of those texts that were edited in the 4th century edits, many of those texts that were lost in the Alexandrian libraries, now that we're recovering them in other ways, those are the texts that tell us the power of human emotion. So look at what's happened. In the year 325 AD, we lost the written validation that tells us of the power of feeling and emotion in our bodies. We may have sensed that it was there, but there was no way to validate that. People, if you don't have a validation, people say, well, am I crazy or what? We so long to have that connection that we developed a completely male-dominated, left-brain-oriented, schematic, logic-based culture and technology, and we've taken that about as far as we can go with it and survive. And now, to have the rest of it, we've got to come full circle and know what the rest of our lives and our relationship to creation means. Our search has brought us back to here. And this is where the power of feeling, emotion, the feminine, the intuitive, are coming into play. Do we create our reality? It may be more accurate to say that we choose which of the realities that already exist we awaken and we breathe into our lives. All the joy, peace, healing, love that you could ever imagine for an individual or for nations or for a world, from this perspective, they're already there. As well as all the sadness, war, disease, and hate. They already exist. They're all there. All those possibilities. The quantum hologram doesn't care, per se. I'm not saying that it doesn't like us. It doesn't have a judgment as to whether one's bad or one's good. The quantum hologram simply responds. It responds to what we become in our lives. This is the language. It's the silent language of emotion. These already exist. There's an additional scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls library that is, it may turn out to be one of the most amazing scrolls of any found, even exceeding the library. This one happened to be found a little bit different way. This scroll is called the Angel Scroll. Interestingly enough, this information first came to light right before the millennium. It was in October 11th, 1999, page 40 of a document called the Jerusalem Report. Now, I've contacted these people about this scroll, and they were very kind in working with me to a degree. They sent me a translation of some of this, and I'm going to share some of it with you here today. Let me talk a little about what the scroll is first. This scroll was not discovered in the 11 caves where all the other scrolls were back between 1946 and 59. This scroll was found by Bedouin herders in the mid-1970s. It's written on parchment about 6 feet long and about 1,000 lines in length. This is a very significant scroll. 6 feet of parchment, 1,000 lines. It's recorded in the languages of Aramaic and Biblical Hebrew, and here's the interesting part. It was found in Qumran, however, it was found on the Jordanian side of the Dead Sea. It was not found on the Israeli side of the Dead Sea. The story I'm going to share with you, it sounds like it would be a great movie. It's a true story. This scroll was very similar to the other Qumran scrolls in some respects. It was different in one respect, in that it was written in the first hand as if it were written by the hand of Jesus. And they believe this may be a scroll that Jesus actually recorded and documented. The Benedictine monks in a monastery in Austria believe that this scroll is so valuable, they found a way to borrow it from the Bedouin herders and the authorities and whisked it away for safekeeping into a monastery in Austria where it resides in this very moment, to the best of my knowledge. That's where it is, for safekeeping. And they are so concerned because it's the only one that's ever been written as if it were written in the hand of Jesus himself in Aramaic. Well, what's interesting about this scroll is it begins to talk about what we now recognize as the quantum hologram, the field of information, and what it means to life. And it begins by talking about the beginning of life, when the seed of a man and a woman come together. It says it's not the beginning of the life, that there's already something there. The seed that is joined from the two seeds, from the man and the woman, is not like a clean slate. It says we've already got information that we are bringing into this world. It's not that we come in as a blank slate. It is written inside, it is written outside, and has in it knowledge and understanding from before its creation and before its creation in the womb. This is a very powerful scroll. It's written inside and outside, and it has both knowledge. Knowledge is simply information. Understanding is what that information means in our lives. It has both knowledge and understanding from before its creation, first of all, and from before its creation in the womb. And then it goes on to say, the beginning of a child is not in the birth or in its conception, nor is its end in death. And then it goes on from there. This is in probably a 22 to 2500 year old scroll. And I believe they're talking about the information of our blueprint. The researchers are now calling the quantum hologram. Well, the key to understanding our quantum hologram is that it reflects what we've become in our lives. So what do Isaiah's instructions mean to us? How can we implement what he said to us? How do we carry out his instructions in our lives if we'd like to do that? In a book, very interesting book, by a gentleman named Robert Bossier, entitled Meditations with the Hopi, by examining modern-day prayers and meditations of indigenous peoples of the American Desert Southwest, Robert Bossier finds what may be a clue to Isaiah's instructions and the way that the vision of peace is implemented in our lives. And I'll just share one sentence from the book Meditations with the Hopi and part of the Hopi prophecy that will lead us into the next section where we actually explore how we implement this internal technology into our lives. What Bossier says in his book Meditation with the Hopis is that when prayer and meditation are used rather than relying on new inventions to create more imbalance in our world, it's then that humanity will find the true path. When we choose to go within and use the technology that lives within every human that's ever walked the earth, what he's saying is that it's from that inner place of knowing and the power that lives within every one of us that we find the true path that allows us to implement the kinds of instructions that Isaiah has left for us. So now we have to ask, could there be a forgotten technique? Is there something in our past that may have been lost, perhaps edited in those lost biblical books that were taken during the 4th century? A way of us communicating from within our bodies to the forces of nature around us that allows us to implement Isaiah's vision of peace, to bring about the kind of healing that allows the deaf to hear, the blind to see, and that dissolves the veil that covers all nations in our lives today. I invite you to join me in the next section as we explore these possibilities through the language of the lost modality of prayer.